What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 5 on Valley Free Radio for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond. We don't care if we live out of state. We don't care if we're a little bit late. Gonna make a scene, baby, me and you. On my rocking bicycle that's built for two. And thanks for tuning in to Out There today. It's Wednesday, September 25th, says the calendar. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. For today's show, I got an interview with my friend Gabor. And that's, we talked for quite a while last night. It's a recorded interview from last night. Also, before I start playing that, I want to make a couple of announcements. Today is the Wednesday Florence Farmers Market from 2 until 6. So go out there and get you some vegetables or fruits. I got watermelon last week. It was really good. And this other kind of melon that Intervale Farm has, that has just like a skin, a peel almost, instead of a rind. And you can eat the seeds too. It's like this yellow melon with a little yellow one like the size of a stumpy overgrown cucumber. But it's sweet. Also going on today at the Forbes Library this evening is a film. It's part of the Northampton Committee to Stop the Wars series. It's a film called Plastic China, tonight at Forbes from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. in the community room. And it's the story of an unschooled 11-year-old girl and her family working in a recycling plant in rural China, thousands of miles away from their mountain village hometown. This film contributed to national pressure in China to drastically reduce the amount of American recycling they purchase. It says experts and activists on recycling will kick off the post-film discussion. Well, I'll be there, but I'm not feeling very expert right now because I'm feeling kind of like I retired from hauling trash because I haven't worked for like 3 days now because I'm getting ready for this Trinidad bike project. I'm just working on bikes now. Speaking of bikes, let me start playing my bike buddy here from Amherst. So I'm here with Gabor. Gabor, actually, like I ask all my interviewees, can you say your name right? I mean, compared to how I might say it.
Gabor Lukács.
So if you've been listening to Out There this summer, you've heard references to the court cases and the bikes. And Gabor was my co-defendant in the UMass bike scheme. That was back in May. But that's pretty much over now, except that we're both still trespassed, I think. I know I am. Are you?
Yeah, for 2 years, probably.
Do you want to say anything briefly about the case? Any sort of synopsis? Listeners have heard me say it enough already.
You already said?
No, past shows, but for new listeners.
Okay. So, the two of us decided that we wanted to send bikes to Trinidad and basically underlying that we wanted all bikes used, and there is always a lot of abandoned bicycles in UMass, so we went to pick them up. And they were really abandoned because they were after this deadline that students have to pick up their bikes. And what was good out of that is that we learned a lot about how those bikes handled and how they are not useful to the university at all, which strengthens our case, but how the UMass police really needs to prove their existence in the summer after the students leave. So that was fabulous for them to catch us. They did catch us.
And yeah, they caught us riding up Fearing Street. Gabor had two bikes balanced on his cargo bike and was riding one-handed with a third bike. He was ghost riding or gliding along, as it says. Gliding, as it said in the police report, gliding a third bike. And then I was riding my road bike and gliding another bike.
Mm-hmm. And they thought all the six bikes are stolen because obviously we are scoundrels who can't show that our bikes are our bikes.
Yeah, the four bikes we had on us and then our two bikes they took and charged us with stealing those two. Anyway.
Yeah. But that gave us a little time to get to know each other even better and to write up this really nice defendant statement, which was really taken well and made a big, big difference, I think.
So we both, in the end, in July, we got 6 month continuation or sentences, like the sentence continued without a finding for 6 months, stay out of trouble for 6 months, and then it'll be dismissed and a fine. Thanks for your assistance paying my fine. Have you stayed out of trouble in the last 6 months?
Well, in a way of them not noticing that I was on university land, but...
I haven't stayed out of trouble, but anyway, as long as I can get out of town soon, I think I'll be good. I'm trying to leave in a couple days to go to Kentucky, and soon after that to Trinidad. But so, Gabor, you're really into bikes? Bikes?
Yeah. I am really into bikes because I'm out of cars. Yes. I really don't like the boxed-in feeling and all the consequences of car driving. Like, I was just coming home today from work. It's a 15-minute ride, and September in Amherst is much more busy than during the summer. So cars were just all the way through. And I was trying to listen to this presentation in my MP3 player and just couldn't understand it because the maximum voice power wasn't enough to override a car. So it's always like borderline, but in September it's always so much busier. And then it tapers slowly down because students figure out that there is other things that they can do other than driving, like riding the bus or something. But yeah, it's this month it's pretty bad. So I'm staying out committedly away from cars. And I also just don't like the culture. I don't like what it does to us. I don't like the comfort addiction that car driving causes in many ways. You know, we have a really great choice to get to places, which is the car. But now we have only that one choice. We don't have a set of choices, just that one choice, because we default to that over and over and over again. And there are people who don't use anything except their cars for transportation, including no buses, no trains, no any kind of public transit. Well, airplanes occasionally. But even walking, there are so many car trips that could be walked. Like how many times, even though I tell my housemates not to drive and not to park because I'm not providing parking, they still have their cars waiting out in front of the driveway, the walkway that I have here. And many times they just sit in there to go to town because they are so used to that.
But you live in downtown.
I live in downtown, so it's a 7 minute walk. Mm-hmm. It's a 7 minute walk, and it's probably 7 minutes to get there and find a parking space.
When you've talked with your housemates, why do you think they choose to drive?
I think it's habituation. It's when I say, oh, let's go to Henyon Bakery, which is very close to here, and we are not going together, then they try to make up time, I guess, to go there, get there quicker, or just, my feeling is just they default there, that, oh, okay, that's how we get to places.
Yeah.
We can sit into the car and go there. Yeah. And for me, it's a big upheaval when I imagine myself having to sit into a car, maybe drive, hopefully not, but then waiting for other people to get out from in front of me and then finding a space for parking.
Yeah.
And then paying for it most likely and then maintaining the car. So... Yeah.
So when you think about how to get somewhere, what do you see as your choices?
I mostly default to bicycles, actually. Yeah. Just I have different kind of bikes when I have to carry.
Which bike should I ride today?
Yes. Well, it's not only that. I have utility bikes. So if I don't have to carry anything, then I can get a lighter bike, which still could carry something because sometimes I find something on the roadside.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm always looking for bottles. Mm-hmm. When there is recycling happening, so I can put my fermented stuff in there and use containers if I find them and whatever. And then if I want to carry something, either a trailer I grow bamboo so I can build bamboo trailers out of that. Mm-hmm. Or a longer bike, a long tail cargo bike that I have, or a long nose, as I call them. Mm-hmm. When the front area is the cargo, then it's a longer front, so I call it a long nose.
Mm-hmm. How many bikes would you say you have?
Oh, I also do this side thingy, which I don't make money on, but basically my commitment is to towards the resiliency. Using bicycles as transportation is much more resilient because it doesn't have to have this big economy and industry supporting it. A car is a complex machine. Bike is not so much. And then if I have several of them, one can break down and the other one can still be used. Yeah. But I want that for my neighborhood too. Yeah. My neighborhood doesn't want that. However, I want, just in case something happens, to provide people ways to still get around. Yeah. Students, however, want it, because they know from each other that there is this way where they can just rent a bicycle for $15 a semester. So my name is passed, my contact is passed from mm-hmm. person mm-hmm. to person. Mm-hmm. And then they would come and would be really excited for getting a whole bike mm-hmm. for $15 for mm-hmm. a semester. Mm-hmm. And then bring it back after they don't need it anymore. Yeah. And that cannot be beaten. So I serve students in that way. Mm-hmm. And I also keep a tab or get to know the generation. I'm over 50 now, so they are very different from me mm-hmm. in their early 20s, late mm-hmm. teens, early 20s. And I still am able to just a little bit know about how they are thinking, how they function, how that generation is different than ours. Mm-hmm. And it's good for them, I think, because they are really happy. So I would say, you asked what is my thinking about transportation. Occasionally, if I want to go a little longer distance out of state or farther away than a bicycle can carry me, mm-hmm. Then I would choose either the train or the bus. I don't fly anymore. I decided mm-hmm. that since I'm always going around trying to not use petrol, it's pretty hypocritical to sit on an airplane and go to another country. So I'm not using that, and I'm not missing it.
You're listening to an interview with Gábor Lukács, a friend from Amherst, and this is Out There on Valley Free Radio. Thanks for listening.
And your blood relations family across the ocean?
Yeah, I'm from Hungary originally, and there is my family. And 10 years ago, when I saw them last, I decided that it's now going to be out of my reach to do that. Mm-hmm. I feel in integrity much more if I don't use an airplane. Mm-hmm. And boats are so inconvenient or impractical anymore because mm-hmm. nobody uses them. Mm-hmm. So I'm not seeing them. Well, they didn't visit me, so I feel okay about not visiting them. But we keep contact with phones and... Yeah. Occasionally emails.
Yeah. When you talk about the resiliency in the infrastructure that automobiles depend on versus bikes, I just think about how, like, with fuel for a bike, you can get it from so many different sources. But fuel for a car, you're pretty much just limited to the gas stations.
Right. And there is also an idea that, you know, cars, there is this little poster somewhere, I forgot where, but it shows a car and says, this runs on money. And then mm-hmm. it shows a bicycle and it says, this runs, the car says, this runs on money and makes you fat. And then a bicycle picture says, this runs on fat and saves you money.
Or so makes you also, money in my case.
Or that, yes. So there is that side of practicalness too, that people just always are short on money. Uh-huh. And partially that's because we have these commitments to spend money on certain things, and the car is one of them. And it's a big item. Uh-huh. Probably after the home, if somebody has that, it's probably the most expensive thing. Yeah. So I'm staying out of the economy a little bit also because I don't want to support it with my own spending and consumption. Other than I don't want to consume either, just in general.
Yeah.
But I also don't want an unhealthy, a non-human economy to be supported by me with my own contribution. So I stay out of it as much as I can. And that's one way.
Yeah.
Getting a used bike or fixing up a bicycle is so much better for my own, feeling my own power.
Yeah.
You know, I feel empowered when I am able to fix up my transportation vehicle.
Yeah.
But how many people can stop on the roadside when they get a flat and change their tires?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many are even ready to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it's not the best weather.
Uh-huh.
And I have done it each way, even in the rain, and succeeded most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And more likely when I go with a bike to somewhere, I'm still, it's a little treacherous occasionally, but I could steal the left of the distance when something happens.
Yeah.
I did have to do that once.
Yeah. So with this Trinidad Bicycle Osmosis Project that I'm working on, so I flew to Trinidad back in the winter, to and from Trinidad back in the winter. I took the bus to Miami, to and from Miami, to get as far on land as I could. But I hadn't flown in 15 years. And now I'm going to be going back to Trinidad in the fall to work on this project. And so I wrestle with that. I wrestle with that because, like you, like I don't really believe in flying. And so... yeah, like how do I justify it? You know, I mean, how? Yeah. I think for me, I'm trying to be like, okay, well, hopefully this will be like a very temporary thing. Like, maybe I'll do it like a couple more times to try and get this project going. But then, like, can I take a boat? There's a website called Find the Crew. .net, but I'm looking at a giant boat hitchhike. Because I know people, I know a couple people from Europe who boat hitchhiked to Trinidad. Anyway, but I wrestle with that.
You know, I remember times where I already felt bad about flying, but I still did it.
Mm-hmm.
So how I justified it is that if I went long enough, then somehow it looked better to me. Like going to somewhere for a whole month and really feel into that space I went to, into that country or into that area, instead of just go there in a day and come back 2 days later because I'm done with whatever single reason I went there. So I integrate it into my life that now it's part of my life because a month is a big part of my life.
Yeah.
That somehow felt better at that time.
Yeah.
Now it's just local.
Yeah. Well, Trinidad is right off the coast of Venezuela, so I could take buses all the way through Mexico and Central America and South America and all the way to Venezuela, and then just like, you know, it's like 10 miles off the coast of Venezuela. But when I think about that, then sailing from Miami looks better and better and better.
I have read somewhere that you can drive across the country in 48 hours practically. Like if you continuously drive, you can bike across and it takes months, but then it changes your life. There is no way that it wouldn't change your life. Driving across may, but most likely will not, especially the fifth time.
Uh-huh.
It's just an interesting, I'm not even sure of that because it can be really hard to drive that long.
Yeah.
Also, another idea is that while I'm, especially the public transportation, while I use public transportation, it's my time. I can read, I can do whatever I want, in, you know, limited. And it is slower, so I would have more time.
Yeah.
I love reading books on the when I have to go somewhere to the bus.
Yeah.
It takes me, instead of 2.5 hours, to visit this girlfriend of mine in Woodstock, New York. It takes me like 6-7 hours instead.
Mm-hmm.
A lot longer time, but it's my time.
Yeah.
And I'm not in danger of dying, most likely. And I have to accommodate to somebody else's schedule, that bus schedule. That's the downside of it. But I also see other people on the way. It's I'm not protected by this box among other people who pass me with great speed in another box.
It's a big box with lots of people in it.
Yeah. It's not as depersonalizing.
Yeah.
I feel together with the folks I'm traveling with, even though they are caught up in their own cell phones or whatever.
Yeah.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm playing an interview with Gabor Lukacs, a friend from Amherst, Massachusetts. I'm with the Wittering, and this is a little music break, a band that Gabor suggested. I'm not really sure how to say it. Something like Bizottság from Hungary. More of the interview with Gabor coming up, but first I'm gonna play another clip from recently that I've been trying to play on my show. This is my friend Kat.
So a friend of mine just stopped by the house. There's a big carrying around a big burden about things going on around town. What's going on with you today?
I just stopped here to say that another friend of mine passed away today, and that we need to create a platform about people who are upper class, lower class, homeless, and in between to talk about heroin addiction, because it's taking a lot of lives. And I've been there, and I'm not there anymore. But every day I stop and talk to people on the street to tell them and what my story is and ask them about their stories. And these are people we walk by every day and we just ignore and make assumptions about. And there are young people dying all the time. And I just want to create a platform where class, culture does not interfere with people's dialogue around just speaking about the kids that they've lost and the people that they've lost in their lives. And that's about it. I'm just really sad.
Yeah, and trying to create more options for recovery that don't involve shame.
Right. People don't want to go for treatment. Like myself, when I was trying to get sober from alcohol, I was afraid to go to the hospital because there's all of these hoops that you have to jump through, and then they tell your information to people. And I think there's a way that people need to have access, immediate access to methadone, Narcan, whatever it is, benzodiazepines, which is what I needed. And just be able to have immediate access to those things without having to, shame themselves, and to reveal, if they want to remain private, all their information to the public. And I know there are programs globally that are doing this right now in Europe, but here in America, we're still working on it. So,
can you just talk about some of the challenges that people face if they want to get into some kind of recovery program?
The challenges are there aren't very many recovery programs except for AA. And the Harm Reduction Center has a Wednesday evening meeting. And I have friends there who are working on trying to create a program in which people can come and detox safely.
For people who might be interested in that, can you give some information about how they can find that?
It's at Pleasant Street in Northampton, Massachusetts, and it's on Wednesday night at 7 p.m. And Albert Parks and Jess Tilly are running a program that's very small and just beginning. And I've been attending it, and I'm inspired by it because I know that it's something that needs to be talked about, because I think more people would come if they weren't afraid of judgment.
Mm-hmm. So what happens there?
We just talk and we share information and we try to create a structure. We're trying to create a structure for people to come in and get information. It's kind of in the new stages right now, but there are doctors who come and visit. There are Karen Moser, my friend's mother, who's very vocal about heroin overdoses since she lost her daughter. Eliza Harper, my friend.
So people are losing lots of like friends and family members. What kind of support? Like, what do people do? Where do they find support when they lose someone close to them?
They have to go and talk to somebody that cares, and there are very few people right now that seem to care, and I care. My name is Kat Bozyak. I live in Northampton. The recovery center is a good option if you have to go to a meeting just to get immediate help or to a resource at a hospital. That's fine, but I think that you just have to find safe spaces, and we're working on that right now. I am, anyways.
Yeah, thanks for sharing.
Thank you for letting me talk.
So,
and this is Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in Northampton. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m., followed by Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock. You can listen to archived editions of Out There at weatherbeard.com/out there. I think there's a link to that on the Valley Free Radio website, I believe. I'm going to go back to more of the interview with Gabor, a friend of mine from Amherst.
So they made a deal, my mom and this woman who had too much milk.
Yeah, I skipped a clip, this one.
Yeah, so another feeling I have about bicycles versus driving a car is that when I ride a bicycle, I ride with my own speed. So I can go as fast as I can because nobody withholds me from that. Mm-hmm. Nobody slows me down, most likely. And I use my own body. I'm involved. And I go and I can slow down and stop if I want. With a car, I really have to go with the speed of traffic. I could always go faster, but I won't, because the speed of traffic is this, and I can get into trouble if I go faster. So if I compare it to other activities, bike riding is reading a book. It's my own speed. Driving a car is more like watching TV. It's their speed. Mm-hmm. I have to accommodate myself to somebody else's mm-hmm. speed. Mm-hmm. That's also an inhumanizing, yeah. dehumanizing yeah. activity, as far as I'm
Plus
concerned.
Plus, with a car, you really have to, I feel like you really have to plan ahead your stops. Whereas the bike, you can stop on a dime and get apples from under the tree, or you can pick up the bungee cord on the side of the road.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, we can't go from here to there because it's a one-way road. Uh-huh. Or that's through the bridge and it will take a long time to get through that bridge or something. Yeah. You know, yes, I agree about that. Yeah. Forget that because I don't have to do that.
Yeah. So when we were biking back from Belchertown, we were riding side by side.
From the court.
From court back in July, we were riding side by side on the rail trail. And at that point, the rail trail has a yellow line down the middle. I believe. And there was a cyclist or two, a couple cyclists coming towards us, single file. We were riding two abreast. And I think you were a little bit across the yellow line into the
what I would call the oncoming traffic's lane a little bit. But then that's all perspective too, right?
Yeah. And then they were still far away, but I think they were scared that I would remain there. And of course, in Europe, the space needs for people for transportation, especially bike riding, is much smaller.
Uh-huh.
Because if you have seen maybe even a little video slip from, for example, big cities in Southeast Asia, where there is not much traffic rules, and everybody like just go, but they go close to each other, and still somehow they get through even the busiest intersection because they watch each other. So that's my strategy a little bit. I'm looking ahead and I see that somebody's coming. So when they are close enough, I get out of the way. But until then, I'm going to keep next to you because we are talking.
But so there's a couple of cyclists coming towards us. Like, I think as we passed by American or New England customs, you were like not as soon or as much into our lane as New England customs would expect. And the cyclist, I think, and she, as she passed us, she said something like, threw up her hand, is like, what about riding single file or something like that.
Yeah.
And so then I said to Gabor, I was like, she's right, we should have been single file, or we should have been, you know, totally into our lane. And he said, really, you think so? And I was like, well, yeah, of course, don't you? And he was like, well, no.
I did say that.
And I was like, well, tell me more. So, yeah, and you were saying how it's almost as if, like, they didn't trust you or something to move over. But, yeah, this whole idea of, like, personal space and, like, Americans want so much personal space.
And then another part to that is social values.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I could imagine that the bicyclists valued the exercise more than connection with each other. I always value the connection with each other more than the exercise, because that was very important in this other culture I'm from, in Hungary, which was a communist country, and we were endangered by the government. So we had to keep together to protect each other almost. So connection with each other was always more important than other things that we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So work was something else we did while we kept connection, or studying was something else we did while we kept the connection. But very rarely do I see that kind of value system in the United States. It's much more I'm doing studying and maybe I connect with others. I'm doing work and maybe if I need to especially, I will connect with them.
Yeah, tell me more about how in Hungary people would prioritize that. What would they do? How would their lives be that would reflect that value of connecting with others?
Mm-hmm. So I knew in Hungary that there is the government, and the government can be dangerous for me. A communist leadership is not on my side. So I knew that there is a culprit there, and I knew that I needed protection from that. The best protection, or the single only protection, was probably in my community. So my idea, and I saw other people around me, idea was also to not necessarily have to be in the right, the center of the community, but be a strong member of the community so that I can use my community for protection. If I don't use that, if I'm sidelined on a community, then like a good predator, the government could pick me up and disappear me during the night because they wanted to make a point, but they wanted to make it cheap. If they upset the whole community by disappear somebody to cause fear, it's not worth it. So they wanted to cause fear in a way that, well, somebody disappeared, this could happen to you. But that somebody wasn't too much liked, so your loss is not that much. Mm-hmm. So you end up with just the fear that it could happen to you, but not the anger that it happened to my closest neighbor or somebody who is important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't an everyday occurrence, of course. But we knew that those are the ground rules. Those are the play, that those are what we had to follow.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew that we had to have a good skill, so we are valuable to our community. In my case, or in my family's case, we had a bunch of peach trees in the well, outside of Budapest, which is a big city. And we would go there during the weekend, take care of the trees, and when the peach ripened, we would bring home, with public transportation, because we didn't have a car, we would bring home these big baskets full of peaches. And people knew that they couldn't use the economy that well, because you go into a store, you don't see fresh peaches, or occasionally no bread or no milk. You can get cans of whatever from last year. But you don't always want cans, so that you either have to know somebody or have to stand in line and maybe be the first person who cannot get what you wanted because it ran out in front of you. So the economy, in a way, supported our communities. It didn't work well. So we had to rely on each other. In the United States, I went into a store and it was just unimaginable to me, the abundance that was in the store, if I had money. And that immediately separates us, because I kind of feel like I compete for the same goods with other people, for the same service with other people, and for money with other people. And in Hungary it was, well, the economy worked, so-so. So everybody had enough money for the, what the economy could give. But if I knew how to get, say, bananas, which very few people knew how to get it, then that skill was a great thing for my community. And in fact, this little thing actually changed my life. You have time? This little thing actually changed my life of being able to get bananas. My mom knew how to get bananas. She had a, some contact with somebody who imported those things. And she got sick after I was born, and at that time Hungary didn't have baby feed, so I guess she didn't know what exactly to give me, or I didn't like what she gave me, so I cried a lot. In the apartment housing, there was a hair salon, and there was a woman there working who also had a baby. She had more milk that the baby needed, and at work she always listened, heard my crying, so she got wet. She started to leak milk. And eventually she came up and asked what the problem is. So my mom told her that she lost her milk. So they made a deal, my mom and this woman who had too much milk, that she would come up and feed me like once or twice a day and give me the extra milk that her baby didn't need. And my mom would make her a smoothie with bananas. And they both felt that this was just a win-win situation. And I was fed, and I actually grew pretty tall. Which, without that, I'm not sure if I would have done. And then there was a really wonderful new connection. And when I was a teenager, I remember she still had the same woman as a to take care of her hair when she wanted to go to the hair salon. She was still working there, and and I was introduced to her that, oh, by the way, this woman was your vet nurse. Which was a big deal for me. Like, oh, wow.
Well, another thing that you talked about last time we were conversing was about, like, in terms of different ways that you would make connections with people, like sexually is, or intermittently sexually is, was also another, like, common way in your community. Can you, like, compare, contrast how you saw that in Hungary growing up versus in the United States?
Right. So our value system there was that the more connection I have with this other person who is in my community, the safer I am. I can have just a high in the morning kind of connection, but I can go further. And with my skill, whatever, if that was, you know, a handyman, or if that was having free time and watching other people's children, or if that was providing peaches for my neighborhood or painting their wall, whatever, that was one more connection. So cooking them, feeding them, having food to give them was one more connection. Having sex with them also was a connection. So we weren't valuing monogamy all that much. The government still was the way that, oh, well, we only approve monogamy. But we didn't think so. It was not mm-hmm. a safe thing. It was too separating. Mm-hmm. So if I had a neighbor who I wanted to have sex with, that was not just, oh, I desire her. It was, no, it's an extra connection. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I would value that connection. So I would make changes in my life if I needed to, or even my personality if I needed to keep that connection so I can keep the belonging. Mm-hmm. And they did the same thing. They wanted to belong. They wanted to do everything so that they are safe from the government. And how it came out is that we all had a looser way of, I guess, personal space, mm-hmm. as we summed up earlier, mm-hmm. and more attention to connection. Mm-hmm. That's a connection. Mm-hmm. That keeps me safe. Great. That's mm-hmm. important in mm-hmm. my life. Mm-hmm. So I had more partners than I would have had in the United States. Mm-hmm. I know that because when I came here, I got married to somebody because, the thinking was behind, well, I'm now in kind of Rome, you know, the uh-huh. and when you are in Rome, do uh-huh. as the Romans do. Uh-huh. Well, everybody is monogamous around me. I have to do that, I guess. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And I felt the loss. I felt uh-huh. the loss of connection, uh-huh. that I'm locked into this personal or family house uh-huh. with my wife, and then other people having the same thing in their own house, separated by lawn or whatever. Uh-huh. And when they come out of the house, they most of the time won't even say hello to me because they get into their car and drive off. Uh-huh. I didn't know my neighbors. That felt so incredibly unsafe. Uh-huh. So incredibly unsafe. So a few months after I have arrived, there started to be a little potluck brunch initiation in my neighborhood, mm-hmm. where by now, that was 24 years ago, mm-hmm. by now we still have this once a month potluck brunch among neighbors. Mm-hmm. Now there are like 200 people on the list. And every first Sunday of the month we get together, we talk, we eat brunch, we take a little bit of food and we share it. And that connects us. So I know everybody's name. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They know what my skills are. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of how I did life in Hungary. It feels a lot safer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And polyamory is just part of it. In Hungary, we didn't have the word. I didn't know what ethical was. I just knew that I have to behave because that was my life, mm-hmm. my safety. Mm-hmm. Here, we have all these politically correct ways to look at multiple relationships because it's mm-hmm. this new thing that people are not so sure about. Mm-hmm. Or, well, most of the people are very sure about. Not for me, mm-hmm. but some people are not so sure about. So they have like, well, I don't know what that is about. But we have to do it ethically. Mm-hmm. So ethical non-monogamy is polyamory. Mm-hmm. That's the word for it.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of a couple things. One is, so when you talk about how sexual relations were in Hungary, but so sometimes people get really attached to yeah. someone they have sex with.
Yeah.
And then how do you deal with attachment and jealousy?
Well, you get attached when you feel lonely, more so. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So, well, here there is a really fine way to feel lonely, kind of. Because our lives are set up uh-huh. in a way that it can uh-huh. happen. Uh-huh. In Hungary, there was already the supporting system around us, which we called community, which we called our neighbors, whatever the name it was. We knew that we belonged. Uh-huh. So that possession mentality wasn't as strong, I feel. Mm-hmm. Especially in my age group. When I was 26 when I left Hungary, so I wasn't a fully mature adult, you know, my values probably was different and I was more flexible about relations. I didn't have children, so mm-hmm. I didn't have to provide mm-hmm. for them. Mm-hmm. But even people with children, they belonged to their neighborhoods, to their communities, as well as belonging to their partner or partners. It was not a singular act. Like here, many couples, when they get together, they fall in love and they are, oh, it's really great. But they lose friends. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They lose friends because their focus is on each other so much, mm-hmm. and then their focus is on their children, that they lose friends who are not in the same situation. Mm-hmm. Maybe they will gain some friends because of the functionality mm-hmm. of children growing up and their children is the same age. Mm-hmm. But that's not, it's not their neighbors most likely. Mm-hmm. It's somebody farther away. Mm-hmm. For us, it mattered. I'm still feeling that if somebody moves away, they kind of move out of my community. That mm-hmm. friendship will not be as strong just because they move away.
Yeah.
I'm thinking a friend of mine is going to move away fairly soon, just to New Hampshire, but out of my biking range.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking less and less of him being in my community. Although I still like yeah. and respect him just as well.
Yeah.
But there is this consciousness that, well, our relationship will be probably much more emailified.
Yeah.
You know, instead of personal.
Yeah. Yeah. What about sexually transmitted diseases and polyamory?
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, when I think about that, just follow me in this process. So here in the United States, people still sleep around some, right? Yeah. We have shorter term, looser, more sexually based relationship maybe because of that loneliness, that need. Mm-hmm. That, well, I have to hook up with somebody because I have to relieve myself or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not that people are really functional in monogamy. It's not true.
Yeah.
They still get around. Maybe not as much as a polyamorous person would. But when you do ethical non-monogamy, polyamory, it's not like you sleep around with people you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, most of my sexual partners were from my community.
Mm-hmm.
And they were longer-term relationships. Most of their connections were also from the community. So if something happened, we would likely figure out what happened. Instead mm-hmm. of, well, I don't know, it was probably those months or those weeks when I was with Brett, but then I also was with Joe. So it's not like that, because Brett and Joe in this case is probably not even in my community. Mm-hmm. Somebody, a cool guy that walked by or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But in Hungary, it was, well, there was somebody I knew for 6 years and the other person I knew for 15 years. I grew up with them.
Mm-hmm.
So if something happened, we would know. And one time, actually, somebody brought lice into the picture. So we all had, you know, this group of people having sex, sharing pleasures with each other. I started to find lice on myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then we tracked it back. And we didn't blame the person because things like that happen. But we asked advice from each other. So what did you do? Well, I shaved. What did you do? Oh, I have this tincture that I put on myself. It wasn't mm-hmm. an alone mm-hmm. process. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't shameful either, because it happened kind of openly.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe all over, but in Hungary also, it's not rare to see couples schmoozing. Schmoozing? Is that the word for it? Smooching?
Smooching.
Smooching on public benches.
Uh-huh.
Partially because there is less personal space for people, but partially, and probably also the population is higher per square mile than here, but also because it's not a shameful activity. It's not deeply shame-ridden, even though at some point Hungary was also Catholic.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Luckily, mm-hmm. communism doesn't like competition, so communism eradicated Catholicism. That was a really good thing that mm-hmm. happened. There were bad things around communism, but that one thing was actually okay.
Yeah, I really appreciate hearing about like this. It's a different social, sexual community way of thinking, like in terms of sexual relations. Because I grew up very much like Christian, like with monogamy being the only right way, and also like sex before marriage was wrong. At one point when I was 17, I decided I wasn't even going to kiss before I got married, that was wrong. I think by the time I was 18, I decided that I wasn't. I was over that one. But yeah, it's just like, it feels liberating to hear about it can be this other way.
Yeah. And actually, it's not like we were loose about it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was 18 and a half when I had my first full-blown connection with a woman, with a mm-hmm. with a girl. Well, she was about my age. And beforehand, I was kind of curious, and there was some segregation in school, so I went to I went to classes usually which was all boys, either because of the school was like that, like the first school was a sport kind of school. That was a general one. The second one was specialized to a certain profession, and in my case it was electronics. Not many women went there for some reason. So I wasn't very close with a lot of women. But once I was, the thinking was always that, oh, that's a new connection. Wow, I can use that for being close with others. Keeps me safe. And it indeed, when you have multiple connections with people you know long term, it's safe. It's safe because you cannot get away with stuff. You have to keep your game clean because otherwise everybody would know. And they don't just know it today and then you move away. You don't move away. In Hungary, people didn't move because the government assigned our housing and they didn't keep assigning different housing according to where we worked. Working was a secondary thing. You worked which was close to you. Everybody has the right in under communism to bread and work, as we say it. And the bread means even if you don't work because you choose not to work, you would get a minimal stipend from the government. But most people would work, and then you would choose your work not because, oh, that's finally I got the job. Everyone can get a job. So you wanted to get a job close to you, close to where you already lived, because it's not going to happen that the government would assign another housing. If you had housing, you stuck with that. And if you weren't there and didn't pay rent, it was still assigned to you 5 years later. Actually, that comes out really well in the... there is this movie, the Unbearable Lightness of Being. It's about Czechoslovakia, where the main protagonist leaves to outside of the country and a year or two later goes back. And just enters his apartment after a year or two later as if it was totally normal. Can you imagine that in the United States, living alone, leaving for 2 years and entering as if it was not a problem? So that's what happened, because nobody would change the assignment. So if it was assigned to you, it would remain assigned to you. That was like a good stability. It also kept communities together. I was in my community for the long run.
Yeah, there's so much transience here.
Yeah.
Which also contributes to a heck of a lot of waste.
And a heck of a lot of mental lack of health. Because we lose our communities. We are tribal beings. I feel it so much. That it's not that we are social beings. We are tribal beings. We have grown... Most of our history, most of our humanly known history, we weren't agriculturalists. We were tribes. And our tribes were occasionally more important than the individual lives. And I feel like that still, that, well, if I have to give up, you know, even if you think it in the United States, if you personally had to give up your life and it would save the whole world, everybody's life would transform and got much better. You would probably think, well, I guess I really have to do that.
Let me go.
Even if you're not not very much of a tribal person. Luckily, it's not necessary. But also, we don't get that kind of power usually to do that. However, I feel that way, that if I had to give up my life for my neighborhood, for my larger community, and everybody's life would... There was no question in my head that, well, my life is less than the whole neighborhood's life. So that's the larger unit. That's always the larger unit. And that's so much more important than my individual singularity. However, if I'm part of a community, I'm an important part of that community also.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you have that belief coming from the sort of communist system, but I also grew up very strongly with that belief, you know, No greater love hath a man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. From like
that.
John 3:16.
And It's noble here. Or
whatever.
It would qualify as such a big noble act. Mm-hmm. In Hungary and in a tribal society, it's not a noble act. Because mm-hmm. everyone do that. Mm-hmm. For a bee, it's not normal to, you know, sting a predator giving up their life. Because mm-hmm. they can only sting once. It's not a noble act. It's what the bee is programmed to do.
Yeah.
But we are also programmed in a way to value community that way. So it's not a nobility, it's not a noble act for me to think that way. It's just who I am.
Yeah.
I'm programmed that way because yeah. I'm tribal.
Yeah. I think about that with biking too. It's like, I biking is good for my community. If I lose my life doing it, that's fine. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want
to. You're trying not to lose it.
I'm trying not to, but it's,
it's not a bad way to die,
no.
as far as dying is concerned. Certainly better than in the hospital, deeply sick and going downhill for months.
So I think that's about the time. Any last thoughts, words of wisdom?
You certainly can choose how to live, and here we have the luxury to choose how we live. I sense that many times I look around and I don't see the wisdom to choose long term. Uh-huh. So we many times prefer immediate gratification. That has been said, but not by me, but much more clever people. But I see it so strongly. Driving a car is immediate gratification, mm-hmm. especially in the winter, where otherwise you would have to put up with the cold or sleet or whatever. Mm-hmm. For me, it's also a satisfying experience when I can keep myself in shape mm-hmm. and not get used to the comfort. So lately, the last 20 years, I guess ever since I moved here, I realized how, because I watch life around me, I think, that's actually comfortable to do it that way. But then I was thinking, something is really amiss about that. And it didn't feel right. My life didn't feel right. So what I started to do almost unconsciously is, I want to make myself a little bit uncomfortable. I didn't know why. I just knew I hate cold water. I wanted to take cold showers. Mm-hmm. How can I manage to start taking cold showers and sticking with it? Mm-hmm. A neighbor actually 12 years ago, asked mm-hmm. me to walk the dog. I don't like walking. She broke her foot, so she had a good ride, and she is getting old. And I started to walk the dog, but I don't like walking, so I ran the dog. Mm-hmm. And the dog was overweight, so in a few months, I ran the dog into the ground, hurt the hip and whatnot, so that was not that good. But I started to run, and it was August, so whenever I came home, I was just hot from the running. Went into the shower and took a cold shower, and it was okay. And then I stopped running, and then, because I don't run if I don't need to run the dog. And I bike. I don't walk or run. So, but then I stuck with that way of, if I take a shower, I take cold shower. And then it got cold, and I still stuck it. And that fall, I remember, was so different. Usually in a fall beforehand, I always felt the Creator doesn't like me. Because it's cold now, I'm shivering, it's so deep into my body, and it's gonna get a lot worse in the winter. Now I don't have that feeling. Since I started to take cold showers, I don't have that feeling, because my body can acclimatize itself somehow for the cold. I still shiver, but it's just shivering. It's not this deep inside my body kind of a feeling. It's not so intimate anymore, the shivering. It's just something my body does. So I don't feel that fear / depression during the fall, looking ahead for the winter of biking around. Now it's just winter, biking around, that's fine. It's going to get uncomfortable, but it's just a 10-minute discomfort. And I come out of the shower, stand in front of the wood stove, and warm up. And that's great. That's a variety of life. So I think that's a good statement. I value discomfort. Because of that, keeps me more in shape.
Yeah.
And it keeps my values straight much more.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. That was an interview with Gabor Lukacs, a friend from Amherst, Massachusetts. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening. I'm actually going out of town tomorrow morning. I'm planning on moving the first bike and trailer towards Trinidad. I'm going to bike to Springfield with the trailer in the morning and see if they'll let me on the Peter Pan bus with it to New York, and then go to TNT Trinidad and Tobago Express shipping depot and box it up and send it on its way on my way to Kentucky. So for the next 4 weeks, you might hear some repeats of the shows, but hopefully I'll be back the first week of November or the last Wednesday in October with a new show. And this is some music control sport. Sorry, my Hungarian pronunciation is terrible.
Senkinek sem kell.